intellectual property, at least in the world of derived schemes. You need to enlarge your world to the world of derived Villeneuve-Mumford stacks. So this conference has stacks in the title, right? Do I need to define Villeneuve-Mumford stack? Should I say any? Well, I'll give a very quick definition, and then that definition will... will immediately generalize to the derived situation. So, definition: now this is going to be in classical algebraic geometry, a classical Villeneuve-Mumford stack is, well, what I'm going to do is essentially take the definition of a scheme and make it a little bit fancier. So instead of having an underlying topological space, we'll have an underlying topos, a topos X equipped with a sheaf of commutative rings, OX, or if you think of a topos as a category, it's a commutative ring object of that category, such that the pair XOX looks locally like spec A O spec A, where A is a commutative ring. Except, instead of thinking of spec A as a topological space with the Zariski topology, by spec A here, I really mean the étale topos of spec A. That is, I consider the topos of étale sheaves on the scheme spec A, together with its the canonical structure sheaf that you have on that topos. All right, so this is a definition of Villeneuve-Mumford stack in the style of the sort of usual definition of a scheme. And now this has an immediate generalization to derived algebraic geometry. A derived Villeneuve-Mumford stack, well, we're going to do the same thing that we did to get the definition of a derived scheme. But we'll still have an underlying space or topos, but instead of having a sheaf of commutative rings, we'll have a sheaf of E-infinity rings, such that the pair XOX is locally equivalent to spec A O spec A, where A is now an E-infinity ring. So now, just like in the definition of a derived scheme, I should explain a little bit further, what do I mean by the étale topos of spec A, where A is an E-infinity ring? Now, in the case of derived schemes, I meant something very mild by spec A. That is, spec A as a topological space with the Zariski topology, it was just spec pi naught of A. And so the underlying spaces of derived schemes are really not any more complicated than the underlying spaces of ordinary schemes. The only complication that's been added is that the structure sheaf is no longer a sheaf of ordinary commutative rings, it's a sheaf in some fancier sense. And the same thing is going to be true for these Villeneuve-Mumford stacks. The underlying topology is not going to get any more complicated. The only complication is going to be that the structure sheaf is a more sophisticated object. So let me make a few definitions. Let F from A to B be a map of E infinity rings. F is étale. Yes, and now it's going to be just like the definition of flatness, except I'm going to replace the word flat by étale. So first of all, the map from pi naught of A to pi naught of B should be étale. This should be an étale map of commutative rings in the sense of classical commutative algebra. And second of all, what goes on for the higher homotopy groups is controlled by what goes on for pi naught. So canonical map from pi I of A tensor over pi naught of A with pi naught of B into pi I of B, and this map should be an isomorphism. So now, we have this notion of an atoll map. There's a crucial fact. Well, so suppose that you have, let A be an E infinity ring. So you can consider A algebras, that is, E infinity rings with an E infinity map from A. So these guys form some kind of a, some sort of an infinity category. But there's a forgetful functor to an ordinary category. Namely, if you have an A algebra and you take pi naught of it, well, then you get an ordinary commutative ring, which is an algebra over pi naught of A. So this maps to pi naught of A algebras. Maybe to emphasize that these are ordinary commutative rings, I'll say this to discrete pi naught of A algebras. So this is a category, and this is some sort of fancier infinity category. And this functor is, of course, nowhere near being an equivalence. That's the whole point of E infinity ring spectra, that they are contain information that is lost by passage to pi naught. But now inside this category, you have a subcategory consisting of atoll A algebras. And now by definition, if I take pi naught of an atoll A algebra, I get an atoll algebra over pi naught of A. And a basic result is this is actually an equivalence of categories. So a priori, the left-hand side here might not even be a category. It might be one of these fancier infinity categories that has non-discrete Hom sets. So part of this, the content of this statement is that actually those Hom sets turn out to be homotopy equivalent to discrete spaces. So what is this saying? If you have any atoll algebra over pi naught of A, there's a unique way to lift it to an atoll A algebra such that it has the pi naught that you're after. And moreover, maps between atoll A algebras are entirely controlled by what's going on at the level of the underlying ordinary commutative rings. So the conclusion is that the atoll topos of spec A is really, so atoll A algebras are just the same thing as atoll algebras over pi naught of A. You could formulate a theory of atoll sheaves on spec A in analogy with the classical theory, but you wouldn't get anything new. They would just be the same thing as atoll sheaves on spec pi naught of A. Yes. So this is the same as the atoll topos of spec pi naught A. So there's no fancier topology in this definition. The only thing that gets fancier is this structure sheaf. Okay, so what? So this is what a Delaunay-Mumford stack is, and the reason for introducing Delaunay-Mumford stacks classically is that you want to construct certain examples that are solutions to certain moduli problems, like classifying elliptic curves. Elliptic curves have automorphisms, so in classical algebraic geometry, you don't expect elliptic curves to be classified by maps into any scheme, because maps into Homs into a scheme, those form a set, and you're ignoring, say, possible automorphisms that your elliptic curves might have. But classically, maps into a Delaunay-Mumford stack, those really form a category, or more specifically, a groupoid. And now in this derived context, well, everything really forms an infinity category. But nevertheless, this notion of a Deligne-Mumford stack is really necessary in order to represent, for example, this functor. You need not only for your morphism spaces to form categories, but for there to be automorphisms of your morphisms that sort of have something to do with the underlying topology and not just these fancier rings. Okay, so now I've explained a little bit about what this statement means. So this statement here, I'm asking for an object which represents this functor, classifying oriented elliptic curves, and what I've told you is the first piece of content is that this functor is actually representable provided that we work in the context of derived Deligne-Mumford stacks. So, the theorem that I want to talk about and that was sort of, well, the main motivation for introducing things that I've been introducing in this course, I want to describe this derived Deligne-Mumford stack, M. So part one is, well, what I've already said, there exists this M derived as a derived Deligne-Mumford stack, such that a Homs from X into M derived is identified with elliptic curves. Oriented elliptic curves. Part two, well, part one might not have very much content. So for example, suppose that there were no oriented elliptic curves. Suppose that it was impossible to produce any examples of this notion that I've defined here. Well, then there would be a moduli space for them. That is, you would just take the empty Deligne-Mumford stack. So part two, we're going to say that this is actually very non-empty. There are lots of examples. So just as with schemes, if you have a derived Deligne-Mumford stack, there's an underlying ordinary Deligne-Mumford stack that you just get by taking the structure sheaf and applying pi naught everywhere. So I'll denote that ordinary Deligne-Mumford stack by putting a bar over things. So this guy is isomorphic or equivalent to the classical moduli stack of elliptic curves. So that's saying that there are lots of examples of these oriented elliptic curves in derived algebraic geometry. Roughly speaking, and I'll be more precise about this in a minute, it's saying that there are roughly as many oriented elliptic curves in derived algebraic geometry as there are elliptic curves in classical algebraic geometry. And statement three, well, in order to describe a derived Deligne-Mumford stack, I need to tell you what the underlying topos is. That's taken care of by two, and I need to tell you what its structure sheaf looks like. So I'll describe its structure sheaf by describing homotopy groups. So these homotopy groups, pi I of m bar derived, are equivalent to, so these, sorry, m derived. If I take the structure sheaf of m derived, so let me mention that these are quasi-coherent sheaves on the ordinary Deligne-Mumford stack, m bar derived. So these are isomorphic to zero if I is odd, and omega to the k if I is twice k. So here omega is the canonical line bundle on the classical moduli stack of elliptic curves. That is, omega, if we think of omega as a rule, it takes elliptic curves. Now we're talking about classical elliptic curves. Elliptic curves over rings R to R modules, and the rule is that is given by E goes to the dual of the Lie algebra. So remember that part of the definition of being oriented was that you had some kind of periodicity in your homotopy groups. That periodicity was twisted by the Lie algebra of the relevant algebraic group. So this evenness, or what these groups look like in even degrees, that's forced on us by that periodicity, by the fact that our elliptic curves are oriented, together with what happens in degree zero, and that's part of statement two. On the other hand, what happens in odd degrees, well, that's a separate statement. What we're saying is, in even degrees, we know what it's got to be. It's got to be something reasonably simple. And in odd degrees, it's the simplest thing that it could be. It's just zero. Okay, so this is a statement. And now let me sort of give another way of looking at this. So, statement two tells me that this M bar derived, this is the classical moduli stack of elliptic curves. And now what we've done is take that classical moduli stack, which I can view as a topos with a sheaf of commutative rings, and we've given it a new structure sheaf. In addition to that sheaf of commutative rings, it also has this sheaf OM derived, which is a sheaf of E infinity ring spectra. So O of M derived gives a sheaf of E infinity rings on this classical moduli stack. And this was constructed by Hopkins and Miller. So corollary, there exists a sheaf of E infinity ring spec on the classical moduli stack. Of elliptic curves, well, with some nice properties. So I won't say, so this is a theorem of Hopkins and Miller, originally, who proved it using methods of obstruction theory. That is, there's a classical picture of elliptic cohomology, which is elliptic cohomology has to do with cohomology theories that are somehow related to elliptic curves. And using that classical theory, you can produce a certain pre-sheaf of cohomology theories on the moduli stack of elliptic curves. And Hopkins and Miller proved that that pre-sheaf of cohomology theories can be refined in an essentially unique way to a sheaf of E infinity ring spectra. And that sheaf of E infinity ring spectra, well, by its uniqueness, it must coincide with the sheaf of E infinity ring spectra that is constructed here, because this, you can check fairly easily, reduces to the classical picture of elliptic cohomology. If you just look at the underlying cohomology theories that you've associated to the affine pieces of the moduli stack of elliptic curves. So that's an easy check if you know what elliptic cohomology means classically, and it probably makes no sense if you're not familiar with what elliptic cohomology means classically. But in the interest of time, I think I'll just go on. So, no. You use another theorem of Hopkins. You use the Hopkins-Miller theorem for the Morava E theories, but you don't use. You don't actually. This is actually a corollary and does not go into the proof of this. Okay, so let me just make a few remarks. If you take the global sections of this O of M derived, you get what people call TMF with delta inverted. So TMF stands for topological modular forms. So this is some E infinity ring spectrum. And the reason that it's called topological modular forms is that it has a very close connection with ordinary integral modular forms that you see in number theory. That is, it's an E infinity ring spectrum, so it has homotopy groups. Well, so I described for you TMF with delta inverted. There's also something called TMF. In order to get TMF, you need to carry out this entire story that I've been describing, but using not just the moduli stack of smooth elliptic curves, but you have to compactify it to allow elliptic curves that develop a nodal singularity. So I'm just going to slough over that point and talk about TMF itself, for which you need the compactification. But the homotopy groups of TMF, there's a natural map from these homotopy groups to the ring of integral modular forms. And this map is very close to being an isomorphism. So this is iso after inverting 6. But it's not an isomorphism before you invert 6. In particular, this ring is torsion-free, whereas this ring has lots of 2 and 3 torsion. Okay, so where does this map come from? Well, integral modular forms, more or less by definition, are given by taking the global sections of these line bundles that you have on the classical moduli stack of elliptic curves. So now, if you wanted to compute the homotopy groups of the global sections of this structure sheaf, well, those are computed by some kind of spectral sequence where the input for the spectral sequence is the cohomology of these quasi-coherent sheaves that live on the classical moduli stack of elliptic curves. So that spectral sequence has an edge map, which is precisely this map here. And the reason that the story gets more complicated at the primes 2 and 3 is that the elliptic curves can have automorphisms which have order 2 and 3, which makes calculations of coherent sheaf cohomology a little bit more subtle in characteristics 2 and 3. Okay, so this, just like thinking about the multiplicative group and all the ways we could orient it, recovered classical complex K-theory. Thinking about elliptic curves and all possible ways that we can orient them, it recovers this theory of topological modular forms, which was constructed by Hopkins and Miller. Okay, so now I guess I have 15 minutes left, and I'm not sure what I want to do with it. Maybe I could say a few words about what goes into the proof of this theorem. But if anybody has anything else that they'd like to hear about, I'm open to changing gears.
No?
Okay. So, sketch proof of the theorem. Okay, so first of all, part one of the theorem is proved by completely different methods than part two and part three. You first establish the existence of this moduli stack, and then you analyze what it looks like. But the methods that you use to construct this are very formal and don't give you any clues as to what it looks like. You have to analyze it by different methods. So to prove one, you use a derived analog. Of Artin's representability criterion. So let me just say a few words about this. So classically, suppose that you have, say, R is some nice commutative ring, and you have a functor from R algebras to sets, or in fancier situations, it might be a functor from R algebras to groupoids. So the main example for us being something like a functor which takes an R algebra to the groupoid of elliptic curves over that R algebra. So let's call this functor F. Now you could ask the question, does there exist X such that F of A is Homs of R schemes from spec A into X? And then we have several different versions of this question depending on what we allow X to be. So if we require X to be, say, an algebraic space, well, so if we require X to be a scheme, as far as I know, there's no really nice answer to this question. And in fact, there are sort of good reasons why there can't be a really nice answer to this question. But if we enlarge the space of classifying objects a little bit, like to the Artin's category of algebraic spaces, or the world of Delaney-Mumford stacks, or the world of Artin stacks, and all of these let's require to be sort of locally finite type over R, then Artin provides necessary and sufficient conditions. That is, these are conditions that you can phrase entirely in terms of the functor F that you're trying to represent. So for example, we're requiring that this representing space be locally a finite type over R. That translates into the condition that this functor F should preserve filtered colimits. So conditions are like F preserves filtered colimits. Satisfies descent for, say, the Atal topology. Dot, dot, dot. So these are sort of the uninteresting conditions. The more interesting conditions are that the functor F should, in some sense, admit a deformation theory. So I don't want to say what that means, but I do want to say that this classical version of Artin's theorem has a derived analog, which in some sense is even easier to prove, or more its content is more clear because deformation theory becomes a lot less ad hoc and a lot more fundamental to the workings of derived algebraic geometry. So the condition that the functor F admit a nice deformation theory, which is one of Artin's classical hypotheses, it really makes a lot more sense in derived algebraic geometry. Okay, so to prove one, you prove this analog of Artin's representability criterion, which is a general result, which tells you that, say, functors now, in the derived context, it would be R would be an E-infinity ring, like the sphere spectrum, and this would be a functor from R algebras to spaces, like the functor that associates to an E-infinity ring the collection of all elliptic curves, or the classifying space for oriented elliptic curves over that E-infinity ring. And then you check that these hypotheses are satisfied. More or less, that amounts to showing that elliptic curves, you know, you can do things with them, like glue them together when you have elliptic curves defined over, well, you can patch them together. If you have elliptic curves defined over two pieces of a space, you can patch them and make an elliptic curve over the entire space. So that's more or less the kind of thing that you have to verify to check that these conditions are satisfied, that the theory of elliptic curves is well-behaved. Okay, so that turns out to be enough to produce some derived moduli space for these things, but it doesn't give you any clues as to what that derived moduli space looks like. So now I have, 7 minutes. So now, well, I don't think I have enough time to really give any coherent account of how this is proven, but let me actually tackle a much easier problem, which is proving the analogs of these statements in characteristic zero. So assertion two roughly says there are lots of oriented elliptic curves. The classifying space for oriented elliptic curves is just as big as the classifying space for classical elliptic curves. So in particular, in some sense, any classical elliptic curve, at least any family of elliptic curves that's atoll over the usual moduli stack, can be promoted to an oriented elliptic curve in derived algebraic geometry. So, question, how to find them? Well, one idea, start with a classical elliptic curve. So, let's say E naught mapping to spec R. So here R is an ordinary commutative ring. Now, I perhaps forgot to mention this, but I should have emphasized that this notion of an elliptic curve, in the special case where X was an ordinary scheme, well, flat, anything that's flat over an ordinary scheme is itself an ordinary scheme. And this just recovers the classical notion of an elliptic curve in usual algebraic geometry. So any elliptic curve in classical algebraic geometry can be regarded as an elliptic curve in derived algebraic geometry, but of course those elliptic curves are not the ones we're interested in because they can never be oriented. Orientability requires some kind of periodicity in the structure sheaf, and in the classical case, the structure sheaf is always concentrated in degree zero. So an idea, nevertheless, let's try starting with a classical elliptic curve and then orienting it. So this is more or less what we did when we analyzed the case of the multiplicative group. That is, we started with a group scheme that we wanted to analyze, the multiplicative group. In that case, we started with that group scheme defined over the sphere spectrum, and then we tried to figure out what it would take to orient that that group scheme. And we found out that writing down an orientation was tantamount to having a map from K-theory. So now we could consider the following question. Well, consider, I have a functor from R algebras to spaces, which is given by sending, so here by R algebras I mean E infinity R algebras, which is A maps to the space of orientations on E naught cross over spec R, spec A. That is, let's consider, we know we can't orient this elliptic curve over R itself, but it's still possible that if I pass from R to some larger E infinity ring spectrum, one that has the right kind of periodicity, I might be able to find an orientation there. And now you can analyze this question in more or less the same way that we analyzed it in the case of the multiplicative group. That is, you can just sort of write down in coordinates what it would take to give you an orientation like this. And I'll just tell you the answer. So this functor is represented by the affine scheme spec of R rationalized adjoin U and U inverse, where U is in pi 2. So we know that in order to orient this elliptic curve, we're going to have to make the ring 2 periodic. And now what this statement is telling you is that if you go out and go and carry out the calculations of what that universal ring classifying orientations looks like, well, it essentially looks like a 2-periodic version of R. Not quite. That only works in characteristic 0. So the upshot is, if you just wanted to construct this moduli stack in characteristic 0, well, you could do it by starting with the classical moduli stack and then studying orientations. And what you find out is that orientations are just classified by some kind of 2-periodic version of the original moduli stack. So this calculation gives a proof in characteristic 0. But it doesn't give a proof in positive characteristic. So what this is suggesting, what this is also telling you, is that this method can't possibly work in positive characteristic. So part of the assertion here, this M derived doesn't just look like the classical moduli stack in characteristic 0. It also contains parts that correspond to classical elliptic curves in characteristic P. But what this is telling you is that if you want oriented versions of those characteristic P curves, you can't possibly get them by starting with the original curves and then looking for an orientation. You have to build some elliptic curves which don't come from classical elliptic curves. So now I think my time is just about up, and I don't think I can give a 5-minute summary of what is involved, so I will stop there. Wait, 5 minutes? But I thought, no. I can describe it for you afterwards, maybe. Okay, so, all right, I'll try and give a very quick summary of what's involved. So Sayre-Tate theory, in classical algebraic geometry, this tells you that if you have an elliptic curve defined in characteristic P, and you want to deform it, then deforming that elliptic curve is the same thing as deforming its P-divisible group. So this Sayre-Tate theory also works in derived algebraic geometry. So what you could do is first try and build. So you could first. So here I said you can't get these elliptic curves from classical elliptic curves by just doing a base change. But what you do expect to be able to do is start with a classical elliptic curve and sort of deform it to a curve defined over an E-infinity ring spectrum and then look for an orientation. So the first thing you do is prove a derived version of this Serre-Tay theorem that says that deforming your elliptic curve in the world of E-infinity ring spectra is the same as deforming its P-divisible group. So now let's suppose it was a supersingular elliptic curve. So then the P-divisible group of a supersingular elliptic curve is essentially the same thing as its formal group. So that tells you that if you want to build elliptic curves over E-infinity ring spectra that deform supersingular elliptic curves, you just have to build their formal groups. And now an orientation, well, there's a lot of ways of phrasing what it is, but one way of saying what it is that it establishes, let me say it in words, an orientation of G over spec A is an equivalence between the formal completion of G and the formal spectrum of the function spectrum A to the CP infinity. So it might be very hard to understand the deformation theory of an elliptic curve because you have to understand the deformation theory of its formal group, but if we want to deform it as an oriented elliptic curve, then what we're doing on the formal group is actually prescribed for us. And that is what gives you sort of control of what it's going to look like, what the universal oriented deformation is going to look like. They use a version of this result. That is, this could be phrased, there's another way of phrasing this, which is, so here I said the deformation theory of elliptic curves in characteristic P looks like the deformation theory of their P-divisible groups. Instead of starting with the theory of elliptic curves, you could start with a more general family of P-divisible groups in characteristic P, satisfying some kind of conditions on its deformation theory. And in this context, you can use the same arguments to prove that it lifts to a sort of... There's some unique lifting to a derived version where you sort of have a derived version of that P-divisible group and some version of an orientation on it. And they use that result in order to build these derived Shimura varieties.